Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 12th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll start with the Siouxlands Day weather forecast. Today will be sunny and warm with a high of 69 and a low tonight of 36. Wednesday could have some showers with a high of 66 and a low of 44. Thursday is also a possibility of showers, and it will be cooler with a high of 46 and a low of 31. Friday will be a little warmer with sunshine and patchy clouds with a high of 53 and a low of 32. And then Saturday is mostly cloudy and breezy with a high of 53 and a low of 23. Today's mini editorial is written by Victoria Knudsen of Sioux City, and Victoria writes, "Other countries do support Ukraine. Sweden joined NATO, and many countries in the area contribute. It is important for us to support them as well. Russian interests do not align with our ideals of freedom. It seems that is being forgotten." Again, this was written by Victoria Knudsen of Sioux City. And our main story today is about the offices of Tyson up in the Dakota Dunes. Dakota Dunes property, mostly empty, has yet to find a buyer. The lavish, largely empty corporate office campus in Dakota Dunes, formerly occupied by white-collar Tyson fresh meat workers, has been on the market for a year. "Several offers have been received on the property at 800 Stevens Point Drive," said Chris Bogenreef, president of the Sioux City real estate firm NAI United. "But none of the offers have met the seller's expectations," he said. "The asking price has not been disclosed. It's listed on the NAI United website as subject to offer." Tyson vacated the property, which anchors the Two Rivers Business Park, last summer. The meat company gave the offices more than 500 white-collar employees the choice of moving to the company headquarters in Springdale, Arkansas. An estimated 262 workers lost their jobs after they opted to remain in Siouxland. Since that time, the property's sprawling office space, 216,618 square feet, of which roughly 150,000 square feet is leasable, has been about 81% vacant, at a time when office real estate has become significantly harder to fill due to the preponderance of white-collar professionals doing their jobs from home. Bogenreef said, "We just don't need as much offices as we used to because of the remote work or even the hybrid work. I don't think we're ever going to go back. It's never going to go back to what it was like pre-COVID." For tax purposes, the 47-acre Class A commercial property is valued at $11.5 million. This valuation does not necessarily correlate to its true market value. Bogenreef said, "There's not an advertised price on it. I can tell you it's probably about 20% of the cost to build new today. So it's a pretty aggressive price, but they did not want to advertise the price." The property is, on paper, still owned by IBP, which built it in the 1990s. IBP barely had time to settle into the new offices before the Dakota Dunes-based meatpacker was acquired by Tyson for $3.2 billion at the beginning of 2001. As the corporate successor to IBP, Tyson owns the Dakota Dunes office complex. IBP, a Fortune 500 company, moved its headquarters from its original home in Denison, Iowa, to Dakota City, Nebraska, site of the company's then new beef plant in 1964. By 1996, the corporate offices moved again, 10 miles away, to the Dunes, a gleaming new plant community in southeast South Dakota. The move was in part for tax reasons. Though the corporate tax savings were not substantial, the company's white-collar workers would save quite a bit in personal income taxes in South Dakota, which does not levy an income tax. IBP's corporate staff had more than doubled in the preceding decade to about 950, and the company had outgrown the old Dakota City offices. Tyson announced his decision to shutter the Dakota Dunes office and other satellite offices in the fall of 2022. Moving all its corporate workers to Arkansas was intended to foster closer collaboration, enhance team member agility, and enable faster decision-making, positioning Tyson to win with its team members, customers, and consumers, the company said at the time. The Dakota Dunes office space is 19% leased, with two tenants. Vizio, the consumer electronics firm, occupies about 30,000 square feet, and Connection, a government tech contractor, takes up about 5,000 square feet. It isn't just any run-of-the-mill office. Among the property's features, a largely open, flexible floor plan, a two-story atrium overlooking a golf course on one end and the property's huge pond on the other, a dining room with seating for 250 people, a full-service cafeteria, two private dining rooms, a private rooftop balcony on the third floor C Street, an underground parking garage, neatly manicured landscaping, and a research and development auditorium. Bogan Reef said of IBP, they did everything top-notch, state-of-the-art, built it very well. In order for the property to be profitable to a future owner, substantial changes would probably have to be made. But there are limits. Radical alterations, like turning it into housing, are improbable, not least because the structure was not in any way designed to be converted to that purpose. Bogan Reef continued, for the right price, it makes sense for developers that would probably purchase it and maybe break it into smaller pieces to lease. That would be the worst case. Best case is there's a user out there that could take the whole 220,000 square feet, but those are a little harder to find in a market this size. So more likely, it would eventually have to be broken up. The process of breaking up offices and common areas intended for one mega occupant and leasing the smaller spaces to multiple office tenants could be challenging. Turning it into a multi-tenant facility is not as simple as just adding more tenants, said Mike McCree, an associate professor of practice in real estate development with Iowa State University. How the utilities are split within the building, how the HVAC systems operate and are split, if you were to multi-tenant it, fire corridors, parking, sightlines, accessibility, all those things are issues that come up when you take a building that was originally designed as a single tenant and then try to multi-tenant it. At the same time as Tyson vacated its Dakota Dunes offices, it also left its offices in downtown Chicago and in suburban Chicago. Tyson has had better luck marketing the downtown Chicago offices. The company is reportedly in talks to sell the property to a private university. But the demand for an enormous piece of high-end office real estate isn't quite so strong in Metro Sioux City, where white-collar jobs have become scarcer over time, even as blue-collar employment has been robust. A property of that sort, built as the world headquarters of a large and deep-pocketed company, and likely best suited for a headquarters, is not an easy sell in a community that isn't home to many world headquarters. It's a hard ask, McCree said. You have to have a very specific reason to be there. The worst-case scenario for the property would likely involve a sort of downward spiral, rather similar to the fate of many shopping malls. Proper maintenance on buildings of that scale costs money. With some vacant or partly vacant properties, if no buyer or tenants are found over a long period, or if a penny-pitching buyer is found, maintenance might be economized. Are they doing it to maintain a Class A approach and a Class A look, or are they doing it on a budget? Those are usually mutually exclusive, McCree said. From there, a property's value and desirability suffers, robbing the owner of the cash flow needed for maintenance, which in turn makes it even less desirable, and so on. McCree said, when a property becomes depressed and you don't have the income streams to the building to just support the general maintenance and upkeep, it does become a distressed property. Bill to help nursing homes advances. A proposal to cap what staffing agencies can charge for the help of temporary healthcare workers, which Iowa's nursing homes turn to as a means of addressing employee shortages, is being considered by state lawmakers. The proposal's supporters say staffing agencies charge so much for temporary nurses that it places a financial burden on nursing homes and other healthcare facilities. But the proposal also has been met with caution from staffing agencies, which insist that billing rates that spiked during the COVID-19 pandemic have been gradually returning to pre-pandemic levels, and warn that capping rates would only make the healthcare worker shortage even worse. Under the proposal, payment rates for nursing services provided by staffing agencies could be no more than 150% of the statewide average paid the previous year. The proposal was introduced by majority Republicans in the Iowa House and passed out of that chamber with strong bipartisan support. It is now being considered in the Iowa Senate, where the proposal went through its first legislative hearing in that chamber Monday at the Iowa Capitol. The stress in the long-term care industry is very real. I think everybody understands that, said Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican from Schleswig, who ran the subcommittee hearing on Monday. I do believe we are going to have a very robust exchange of ideas on this one, but that indicates just how much money is at stake on one hand and how difficult the long-term care industry is on the other. Iowa's nursing homes are losing money. Had it already been in place, the proposed legislation would save the industry $22 million this year, according to the testimony of Brent Willett, president and chief executive officer of the Iowa Healthcare Association. Willett said during the meeting, "Those dollars could be reinvested in increasing wages for permanent direct care staff, hiring more people, and not directed predominantly to out-of-state staffing agency profit margins." But the proposal could have the opposite of its intended impact, argued Bob Livonius, chair of the American Staffing Association and member of Grape Tree Medical Staffing based in Milford. Livonius said nearly two-thirds of nurses who work through staffing agencies have other full-time jobs, and that those nurses could be driven out of staffing positions if the proposed legislation becomes law. He said that would create even more strain on nursing homes when they look to staffing agencies when in need of temporary workers. The organization that represents Iowa nurses shared that concern during the hearing. I will say nurses feel very targeted by this. There is a very negative reaction to this legislation, said Amy Campbell, a lobbyist for the Iowa Nurses Association. There are other traveling professions that have similar profit margins that are not included in this, so they felt very pulled out and targeted, and they have deep concerns that this is actually going to have an opposite effect. Senator Todd Taylor, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, said his viewpoint on the proposed legislation has gone back and forth. I spoke with a lot of people last week. I was for the bill, I was against the bill, Taylor said. And this is not with any snark at all, but many of the bills that I've seen in this legislation, there's not really a problem that we're fixing. Here, I see there is a problem. I am concerned. Is this the right fix? The bill, House File 2391, previously passed the Iowa House on an 80-17 vote. Schleswig and fellow Republican Senator Don Driscoll from Williamsburg advanced it out of subcommittee Monday, making it eligible for consideration by the full Senate workforce. Schultz said the goal is to at least pass the bill out of that committee in order for it to qualify for this week's legislative deadline and remain eligible for consideration. And now our next story is concerning the Sioux City Council. Wastewater plant vote expected next week. Representatives from a Minneapolis environmental engineering firm told Sioux City Council members Monday that the construction manager at risk, CMAR project, delivery approach for the first phase of the rebuild of the city's aging wastewater treatment plant is likely going to be the most attractive way to go. Proposing to do phase one as one large contract gives the city an economy of scale, which means you're going to have larger, more national contractors focused on bidding this project in order to achieve that economy of scale. And you're just, frankly, likely to get a lot more bids, better bids by going the CMAR route, we feel, in this particular project, said Hazen and Sawyer's Gary Hobner, who is the project director for the wastewater treatment plant improvement project. Hazen and Sawyer delivered a presentation about project delivery methods during the council's weekly meeting at City Hall. Hazen and Sawyer is providing design, site survey and geotechnical investigation, construction administrative and observation, as well as post-construction services for the project. Last year, the council, in spite of objections from the business community, approved a residential, commercial, and industrial sewer rate hike to help fund a projected $470 million three-phase rebuild of the plant at 3100 South Lewis Boulevard. The council has committed to the first two phases of the project, which consist of rebuilding the plant at its current location and also slightly increasing the plant's capacity, which the Iowa DNR is requiring. The plant poses significant safety issues for the city staff and has a history of compliance issues with the state. In January 2022, the DNR filed suit against the city over alleged repeated environmental violations at the plant, which dated back to March 2012. The city faces fines adding up to millions of dollars. The first phase will address all safety and reliability issues associated with the liquid stream treatment process, along with odor control at York, Floyd, and Riverside lift stations. The second phase will address reliability issues with the solids handling processes. In fiscal year 2025, $300 million is being requested for construction and $12 million for odor control. The funding source for the $312 million is Sewer Iowa revolving loan proceeds. The council has two main delivery methods to choose from for the project. DBB, which is Design Bid Build, is the traditional method of delivery for construction projects. Design, publicly advertised, contractors bid. The lowest bid is selected. Cost alone determines the successful bidder, and the contractor is not involved in the design in this method, which has been used by cities and municipalities for infrastructure projects for decades. Although CMAR has only been authorized for water and wastewater projects in Iowa since July 2022, it has been used in other states for the past 20 years. CMAR presents potential financial benefits through early contractor involvement, value engineering, and risk mitigation strategies. CMAR's upfront costs may appear higher, but it has the potential to reduce change orders, project delays, and overall construction expenses. The key feature here is that the city is really typically locked into the low bidder under the design bid build process, Hobner said. The contractor is really only involved in the project at the time of bidding. They have no involvement through the design process. The first time they're seeing the project is when those bid documents are publicized and advertised. With CMAR, Hobner said the construction management firm is brought on during the design process and selected on a best value basis. So you can consider cost along other factors and get the right fit for the city to act as the construction manager and then subsequently at the contractor as well, he said. They're able to look at the design as it's progressing and provide input on matters of constructability, matters of cost, sequencing. Hobner said that local and regional contractors will be pulled into the project with either delivery method, but he noted that will particularly be the case with CMAR. Just because the size of the project, it's just more economical to use local labor forces when they can, he said. In regard to the project delivery method, Mayor Bob Scott said he's not sure if he's for or against anything. They've got to be a pretty darn good contractor, whether you hard dollar or whether you construction management, Scott said. You may get one guy that bid outside the scope and territory, but I don't think there's any difference in the first line. I really don't. Just because you've got to have a lot of not only money, but a lot of expertise to bond a $200 million job. As we talk, there are very few contractors that can handle this. Scott asked Hobner for the closest sewer plant project to Sioux City. They responded that they've done work in Denver and the Twin Cities. He said, we've done a variety of different ways. We've done a lot of hard bid projects. We've done a lot of CMAR projects. The council is expected to vote on the project delivery approach at its next meeting. Sioux City woman charged in machete attack. A Sioux City woman was arrested Sunday on suspicion of attacking another woman with a machete. The incident occurred at approximately 2:30 p.m. in an alley north of the 400 block of 14th Street, where, according to court documents, Iona Lasley exited a vehicle after yelling at a female transient. Lasley attacked the other woman with a 12-inch machete, knocking her to the ground and hitting her with a machete in the leg, face, and hands. The woman suffered serious cuts and was transported to a hospital. Lasley ran from the scene with a machete, court documents said, and ignored commands from a pursuing officer to stop. She dropped the machete and continued to run until stopping in the 1400 block of Douglas Street, where she was apprehended and arrested. While in custody, she was found in possession of a glass meth pipe. Lasley, 37, was booked into the Woodbury County Jail on felony charges of willful injury causing serious injury and going armed with intent and misdemeanor charges of assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, interference with official acts, eluding a peace officer, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Her bond was set at $25,000 Monday morning. Sioux City man pleads not guilty of arson. A man charged with setting a garage on fire at a Sioux City mobile home park has pleaded not guilty. The lawyer for Mario Arias, 31, of Sioux City, entered the written plea Sunday in Woodbury County District Court to charges of first-degree arson and driving while license barred. Arias was arrested February 21st, and charged with setting the fire at Evergreen Village at 5309 Highway 75 North. Police received a report of a disturbance at the mobile home park, and according to court documents, the caller reported her husband was burning down the garage. After firefighters arrived and began putting out the fire, Arias attempted to flee in a vehicle and drove over fire hoses. He was stopped by officers and apprehended. After the fire was extinguished, investigators found accelerant pore patterns between the detached garage and the home. Arias' clothing also had a strong odor of gasoline, court documents said. There were no injuries from the fire. SCPD investigates woman who tried to lure child. Sioux City police have found the woman who allegedly attempted to lure a 10-year-old girl into her vehicle Saturday. We have located the suspect and suspect vehicle in the incident that occurred on Saturday afternoon with the 10-year-old girl and the Ford Bronco. The suspect is currently cooperating with investigators, and I will update you further when their investigation is complete, Sioux City Community Policing Sergeant Tom Gill said Monday afternoon in a statement. According to a Sioux City Police Department Facebook post, at 5:45 p.m., the woman attempted to get the girl into her vehicle in the 4500 block of Cheyenne Boulevard. The driver asked the girl several times to get into her car and told the girl she had cancer. Sam Clovis settles negligence suit against hospital doctors. Former Sioux City talk radio host Sam Clovis has reached a settlement of a negligence lawsuit he filed against a Sioux City hospital and several doctors. Clovis and his wife Charlotte of Hinton had said a number of doctors failed to diagnose a thoracic spinal cord abscess in 2019, resulting in spinal damage that left him a paraplegic who needs around-the-clock care. He sued the five doctors, Unity Point St. Luke's, Regency Square Care Center, and Family Health Care of Siouxland in April 2021, saying alleged negligence led to a failure to diagnose and treat a staph infection or order imaging that could have detected the abscess earlier. In an order filed March 4th in Woodbury County District Court, District Judge James Don said he had been informed all claims had been settled. Because a number of the settlement details would take time to resolve, Dane scheduled a settlement status conference for July to ensure the lawsuit is resolved and dismissed. Clovis attorneys Stan Munger and Mark Humphrey declined to comment. Clovis, a former Morningside College professor and Republican political operative who served as a policy advisor to former President Donald Trump, could not be reached for comment. A lawyer for Unity Point also declined to comment, and a Unity Point spokeswoman said the health system had no comment. According to the lawsuit, Clovis went to the Unity Point St. Luke's emergency room on April 21, 2019, complaining of chest pain that radiated around to his back. Chest x-rays showed no broken bones, and doctors prescribed him painkillers. Clovis continued to have chest and back pain and shortness of breath and was later admitted to the hospital and treated for suspected pneumonia. The lawsuit said blood samples taken showed the presence of staph infection, but it appeared that none of the treating physicians were ever notified of the test results. While hospitalized, Clovis complained of weakness in his legs and ongoing pain in his back. After being transferred to the hospital's rehabilitation wing, an MRI of Clovis's lower back showed a narrowing of his spinal canal, but no imaging was done of the areas of his back where Clovis said the pain was located. He was transferred to the Regency Square Care Center in South Sioux City to continue rehab and continued to have back pain and weakness and numbness in his legs. About 3 weeks later, he was admitted to the hospital and had an MRI of his mid and upper back. The results showed an abscess, and Clovis had surgery to drain it. The surgery caused little to no change in his paraplegic status, the lawsuit said. Clovis had been seeking a judgment awarding him and his wife damages to compensate them for past and future medical expenses and loss of bodily function, pain and suffering, past lost earnings, and loss of future earnings capacity. Tyson to close Perry pork plant in June. The largest employer in Perry, a Tyson Foods pork processing facility, is set to close permanently in June. A Tyson spokesperson on Monday confirmed the pending closure, but declined to say when it would happen. Perry Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh said the company told him the plant would close June 28th. The facility employs nearly 1,300 people, whereas the next largest employers in town have 100 to 150 employees. Perry, in central Iowa, has about 8,000 residents. It was a complete shock to me, Kavanaugh said. It's going to affect everything. Everybody is going to feel the pinch. Tyson said the closure is a result of our focus to optimize the efficiency of our operations to best serve our customers. After careful consideration, we have made the difficult decision to permanently close our Perry, Iowa pork facility, the company said Monday in an emailed statement. We understand the impact of this decision on our team members and the local community. Tyson said it has more than 9,000 employees elsewhere in Iowa, which is said is a key state for the company. The closure announcement follows some financial troubles for the company. It reported a loss of $648 million for its fiscal year that ended in September. About $400 million of that loss came in July, August, and September. The Perry processing plant has existed and expanded under various ownership for nearly 60 years. Its future is unclear. Kavanaugh said he did not yet know whether Tyson is willing to sell it to another meat processor or whether another processor would buy it. How the town is going to recover, I don't know, he said. Tyson said it is encouraging its Perry employees to apply for open jobs elsewhere in the company. The company said, we are also working closely with state and local officials to provide additional resources to those who are impacted. We'll now move to the regular Tuesday column of Five Questions With. And today it is Denny Anderson, the Big Daddy of Trivia. Denny Anderson, the Big Daddy of Trivia Nights in the Sioux City Metro, has found his services in big demand. Anderson, a Sioux City radio figure, parlayed his Big Daddy broadcast persona into a sideline as a trivia impresario about 8 years ago. What started out as a casual way to bring customers to local bars has blossomed into entertainment for the professionals. He's traveled as far as Pella, Iowa for gigs. Local bars are still key partners in the enterprise. We are starting to do a lot more corporate events, Anderson said. They have the option to get a hypnotist, a comedian, a band, or a trivia guy. So I'm getting more and more trivia gigs. The Journal recently turned the tables on Big Daddy and asked him some questions about his place in the local trivia industry. Questions and answers have been lightly edited for clarity and style. Our first question, where does the name Big Daddy come from? It came from my radio on-air name. I'm Big Daddy in the morning on Classic Rock 99.5 radio, so it's just kind of tied in together. I was given the radio name Big Daddy years ago by my general manager, Dennis Bullock, in my past radio life. I've been Big Tom Hammer, Big Al Knight, and my GM said, why don't you just be Big Daddy? Next question, how did you get into the trivia business? It started out, I've got a friend in Colorado who is in the radio business and was having success with trivia business out there. And when I was talking to him, he said, you should try it in Sioux City. So we did. We started. My wife and I kind of started the thing up as a date night out. We only did one night a week, but it just kept catching on with other bars and other establishments. And we started booking more and more places, and we're now doing a lot of them. How do you choose the topics for your trivia nights? They seem kind of pop culture heavy, not quite as many 18th century France trivia nights. Well, that's the nice thing about having a connection with somebody who's got the trivia business in Colorado. He does 22 different bars out there, so I get all my games from him. If I had to come up with the questions individually, it would take too long, and there probably wouldn't be a Big Daddy trivia. Do people ever cheat at trivia? Do you monitor for that? I've had to kick out one lady one time a few years back for not putting the phone down. She said she was using it to stay in touch with her daughter who was in labor. But when I looked at the score, she wasn't missing a single question, and that's kind of unusual. So I had to actually kick her out. We catch some young people once in a while, it seems. The ones that may be college age that can't necessarily afford the amount of money for a beer in a bar. So they try to find different ways, maybe a smartwatch. We've seen it, but I can pretty much tell who's cheating just by looking at the scorecard, because it's pretty seldom that you're going to get every single one right. It's only happened once in my 8 years of doing this. And then, trivia question for you. King Edward VIII abdicated the throne in 1936 to marry who? And he answered, Mary, Queen of Scots. No, the answer was Wallace Warfield Simpson. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 12th. on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now go to the obituaries for today. Larry Tony Peterson, 93, of Lamar's, passed away Thursday, March 7th, after a very short stay at the Good Samaritan Society Nursing Home in Lamar's. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 13th, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Lamar's. Reverend Kristen Meyer will officiate. Burial with military honors provided by the Wasmer American Legion Post 241 of Lamar's will be at Hillside Cemetery in Merrill. Visitation with the family present will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, March 12th, at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. There will be a prayer service at 7 p.m. Visitation will resume from 10 a.m. until service time on Wednesday at the church. Arrangements are with the Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. In lieu of flowers and gifts, memorials can be made in Larry's name to the Lamar's Community School Foundation, Floyd Valley Healthcare Foundation, or a favorite charity of your choice. Larry Albert Peterson, the son of Albert and Magdalena Peterson, was born on November 26, 1930, on the family farm near Merrill, Iowa. He attended country school near Merrill and later high school in Lamar's. He graduated from Lamar Central High School in 1948. Following high school, he began farming with his father. He enlisted in the United States Air Force in 1951. He was stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama during the end of Korean War. Before his enlistment, while umpiring a baseball game in Merrill, Larry's colorful Hawaiian shirt caught the eye of a young Sioux City lady named Luann Lamoureux. As they say, the rest is history. They married on November 16, 1951 in Montgomery, Alabama, while Larry was in the service. Following his discharge in 1953, they returned to the family farm near Merrill. Larry farmed until his retirement at the age of 62. Even after retirement, he continued to help his son, Jeff, on the farm. In 2004, Larry and Luann moved to Lamar's. Larry was active in many civic and community organizations. He always said he enjoyed nothing more than a good meeting. He was truly a man who believed in serving his community, and in doing so befriended so many people from many diverse backgrounds. He served on the Lamar's Community School Board, Floyd Valley Hospital and Foundation Boards, Northwest Iowa Education Agency Board of Directors, Farm Credit Service Regional Association Board, Lamar's Community School Foundation, the Lamar's Chamber of Commerce Ag Committee, Plymouth County Drug Court, and others too numerous to mention. Larry was a lifelong member of St. Paul Lutheran Church, Johnson Township, and rural Merrill. After moving to Lamar's, he became a member of St. John's Lutheran Church. If you met Larry, you knew him. He had the ability to talk to anyone about anything, and his kindness was infectious. He loved his wife, his family, his community, and a good basketball game, especially the Iowa Hawkeyes. Larry was a genuine, supportive cheerleader for every person he met, from receptionists at his doctor's offices to CEOs of organizations he was involved with to family members he loved so dearly. He was the kind of guy who never failed to thank a waitress for the nice service. We will miss his voice, his signature whistle, and his big heart. Carolyn Parker Jacobson, 75, Mobile, passed away March 7th. Memorial service will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside, with visitation 1 hour prior. Mary Ann Berg, 92, of Sioux City, died Saturday, March 9th. Memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 14th, at Calvary Lutheran Church. Visitation will be Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Jeanette Ann Burnite of Sioux City died on Friday, March 8th at the age of 97. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Thursday, March 14th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, with Reverend Christine Stengy of First Lutheran Church officiating. Interment will follow at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will begin at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, prior to the service at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the Holy Family Food Pantry at First Lutheran Church, Sioux City. Jeanette was born on September 15, 1926, the daughter of Louis F. and Mina Sasuski. She attended Sioux City Public Schools and graduated from East High School in 1944. She was at East High that she met the love of her life, Raymond Burnite. He he a standout football player and she an enthusiastic cheerleader. Separated during his service in the South Pacific Theater during World War II, Jeanette worked at Western Union typing telegrams. Ray and Jeanette were married at First Lutheran Church in Sioux City on November 29, 1947. Jeanette's many interests and volunteer activities kept her always on the go. A member of First Lutheran Church in Sioux City, she was a Sunday school and Bible school teacher and served faithfully on the Altar Guild for many years. She served as den mother for both her son's Boy Scout troops for several years and raised two Eagle Scouts. She was an accomplished artist and poet, a skilled cook and a homemaker. She always had a craft project underway, and her holiday dinner tables were a work of art. No one ever left her house hungry. She enjoyed golf and bowling, playing on several local leagues, and collected many trophies. In addition to her many other activities, Jeanette held several positions outside the home. Over the years, she worked at Sears, Linda Lee's, Willig's Clothing Store, and also at State Finance Company, where she put her bookkeeping skills to good use. She was a longtime member of Eastern Star, receiving her 50-year pin. Some of her fondest memories were those she created marching and traveling with her friends in the Daughters of the Nile, for which she served as Supreme Queen of Hathor Temple in 1987 and 1988. She was a member of Iota Delphian Study Group, the Girls of 44, and a longtime PEO member. Jeanette loved to dance and never wanted to miss an episode of Dancing with the Stars. She and Ray belonged to a dance club for several years. She was an active member of the Happy Hoofers Tap Dancing Troupe and loved to perform at local athletic halftime shows and dance contests until her late 80s. Jeanette loved to travel, particularly cruising. Avid boaters, she and Ray were members of the Missouri River Boat Club from its inception. With friends and family, they sailed the Missouri and Mississippi rivers from Chamberlain, South Dakota to New Orleans on the Jeannie, their boat named for her. Lou Ann Lundy Goble, age 68, from Alexandria, Minnesota, formerly of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, February 24th, in Alexandria. Lou Ann was born July 27, 1955, in Sioux City, to Lewis and Wilma Lundy. She grew up in Sioux City and attended Sioux City schools. After graduating high school, she attended Iowa State University and Morningside College. After college, she worked for many years at Sioux City Public Libraries while raising her son, Lewis. While working, she met her husband, Mark Goble. They were married in Sioux City in 2000. They moved to Des Moines in 2001 and subsequently to St. Cloud, Minnesota. They moved to Alexandria in 2010, where she lived for the remainder of her life, making many dear friends. She loved her family and her friends. She loved shopping and rides in the country. Fall was her favorite season. She loved animals, especially her cats, Sammy and Midnight. A gathering of remembrance will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, at the VFW in Alexandria. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in her name to the Outreach Food Shelf of Alexandria or to a charity of the giver's choice. Jeremy Patrick Doucette, 46, of Mobile, passed away Monday, February 12th, in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, March 17th, at the Mobile Community Center at 815 Main Street. Kostler Funeral Home and Monuments of Ottawa is in charge of arrangements. Helen L. Maxwell, age 94, of Mobile, passed away on Tuesday, March 5th, at her home in Mobile. A celebration of life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 12th, at the United Methodist Church of Mobile, with the Reverend Dr. Eric Sionkin officiating. Burial will be at the Arlington Cemetery of Mobile. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, March 11th, at the Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home in Mobile. Helen Louise Logan was born in Sioux City in 1929. She graduated from high school in Mobile. She received her child development BS degree in 1951 from Iowa State College, now Iowa State University. She was a member of Pi Beta Phi for 75 years. Helen met her soulmate, Earl Edward Maxwell, in Ames while both were attending college. Earl was from Galesburg, Illinois, and received his DVM degree from Iowa State College in 1949. Helen and Doc were married on April 14, 1951, in Mobile, and were married for 71 years. They lived in Elmwood, Illinois, for 2 years, where Doc practiced veterinary medicine and Helen worked at the Farmer State Bank. Doc and Helen moved to Mobile in 1953, founded the veterinary practice, and started Maxwell Farms. One of their North farms was part of the Louisiana Purchase in 1860 and is an Iowa State legacy farm. Helen was instrumental in helping manage and grow the businesses. Three boys and one girl were born to the Maxwells, Stee, Chantry, Tad, and Reed. Helen was above the curve on organization and planning, and she and Doc made sure the family enjoyed sports and scouting, with all the three boys attaining Eagle Scout Award, and Chantry attained high ratings in Girl Scouts. Helen's organizational skills allowed the family to be involved in extracurricular activities at school, church, numerous pets, farm work, camping, traveling, and entertaining foreign visitors. The whole family helped in the veterinary practice and on the farm, starting at a very young age. Repurpose, reduce, and recycle were instilled in Helen as a way of life, garnered from growing up through the Depression, which she imparted to her children. Helen loved children and had a lifelong interest in child development. She was a preschool class teacher for the United Methodist Church for over 20 years. She continued her formal degree by taking additional classes in Montessori schooling and receiving her endorsement, as well as continued lifelong learning in the field. Helen and Doc always had an interest in traveling in order to broaden their worldview and experience other cultures. They traveled extensively throughout the United States and the world, visiting all 50 states and 125 countries. Helen was an eclectic reader, a wonderful cook, and enjoyed planning the family's travels and enhancing their home. Helen's activities included being a member of the Sioux City YWCA Advisory Board, Planned Parenthood Board, Sunday School and Bible School teacher, Boy Scout Den Mother, Girl Scout leader, Women's Club, Iowa State University Legislative Contact Program, Phi Beta Phi Alumni Club, Terrace Hill Society, Salisbury House Foundation, and the auxiliaries of the Veterinary Medical Association, St. Luke's Hospital, Abu Becker, and Eastern Star. The family supported numerous community initiatives and activities, including the Maxwell Memorial Remembrance Park, the Masonic Lodge, the E.E. and Helen Maxwell Family Scholarship Fund for Woodbury Central graduating students, Mobile Medical Clinic, and World Food Prize Hall of Laureates. Helen and Doc spent their lives committing personal time, resources, and money to varied organizations. Helen lived the model of making her community and the world a better place and giving back. She loved and appreciated her Mobile community, the peacefulness of small-town life, and numerous opportunities to observe and be around wildlife. Devoted Iowa State University graduates, Doc and Helen were members of the President's Circle of the Order of the Knoll at ISU. Helen was a member of the College of Family and Consumer Sciences Ring of Life-Giving Society and supported the Child Development Library at Iowa State University. Both were active in the Iowa State University Alumni Association and the Iowa State University Achievement Fund Drive for the College of Veterinary Medicine. Helen and Doc were strong supporters of the Cyclone football program, were season ticket holders for almost 50 years, and were the 1977 ISU Parents of the Year. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be given to United Methodist Church of Mobile, Mobile Medical Clinic Fund, Mobile Women's Club, or Mobile Historical Society to help our community. Dr. Carolyn J. Rance, 87, of Sioux City, died at her home unexpectedly Friday, March 8th. A celebration of her life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at First United Methodist Church, with visitation 1 hour prior. The family is being assisted with arrangements by Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside Chapel. Carolyn Rance was born October 3, 1936, in Hastings, Nebraska, the daughter of John and Christine Halloran. She graduated from Hastings High School, attended Hastings College, and later received a B.Ed. from the University of Omaha, and Master of Education from the University of Nebraska, and a doctor from the University of South Dakota. She married Marvin Rance in 1957, and they later divorced in 1984. Carolyn began her 50-year career in education teaching elementary schools in Nebraska and Michigan, then later as a faculty member in the education department at Morningside College, and vice president at both Morningside College and Western Iowa Tech Community College. She retired in 2007. She was active in many organizations. Carolyn was a 60-year member of the Delta Kappa Gamma Society International, DKG, a professional honorary society for women educators, and served as a state president from 1997 to 1999 and international president from 2008 to 2010. During her term as president, she lived in downtown Austin, Texas. Carolyn received the International DKG Achievement Award in 2011 and the State Achievement Award in 1999. Carolyn was a member and president of Phi Delta Kappa and was commended with the Bessie Gabbard Award celebrating leadership of women in Phi Delta Kappa in 2001. She was a 50-year member of PEO and a 39-year member of Quota of Siouxland. Carolyn was active in her community and state, serving on many boards and commissions from the Partners Board at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital, the Sioux City Symphony, Leadership Sioux City, the Siouxland Y, Girls Inc., and the State Board of Iowa Civil Rights Commission and the Vision Iowa Board. She was a longtime member of First United Methodist Church and served on most boards and committees. She enjoyed playing handbells at the church. Carolyn was passionate about music and most recently was teaching piano to young students at the church. Carolyn enjoyed traveling, visiting all 50 states and numerous counties. She enjoyed art and numerous card clubs, but her greatest passion was for instilling the values and qualities of leadership in other women. It was not lost on anyone, least of all her granddaughters, the irony of her passing on International Women's Day. Memorial gifts may be made to Delta Kappa Gamma, or First United Methodist Church. Leslie Lee Jones, 74, of Whiting, died Friday, March 8th. Services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at the Gosta Funeral Home Chapel of Ottawa. Burial will follow in the Ottawa Cemetery with military honors. Gosta Funeral Home and Monuments are in charge of arrangements. And that concludes the obituaries for today. Our next article, westbound U.S. 20 east of Sioux City to close. Entering and leaving Sioux City on U.S. Highway 20 will soon take a little bit longer. The Iowa Department of Transportation plans to shut down the westbound lanes of the four-lane highway east of Sioux City next Monday, so work can begin on the second phase of reconstruction of 2 miles of the highway east of the city. Westbound traffic will be shifted to the eastbound lanes, creating a head-to-head traffic pattern from the U.S. 20 Gordon Drive and U.S. 75 interchange east to Carroll Avenue for the next several months, while workers move tons of dirt to flatten hills and fill all valleys and repave the route into Sioux City. During construction, no left-hand turns will be allowed in the work zone. Temporary stoplights will control traffic just east of Sioux City, and eastbound and westbound U.S. 20 traffic planning to turn north until U.S. 75 will be detoured south on U.S. 75 to the Morningside Avenue exit. A temporary stoplight at Morningside Avenue will control traffic crossing the bridge over the highway and entering the ramp to northbound U.S. 75. Work also includes the reconfiguration of the U.S. 20 interchange with U.S. 75. Construction is estimated to be finished by November 22nd, weather permitting. The eastbound lanes were closed and rebuilt in 2023, the first year of the two-year $32.6 million project. The project's purpose is to even elevation differences between the eastbound and westbound sides. With the driving lanes on a more even elevation, driver sight distances are increased, making for safer travel, DOT officials have said. IDOT and Sioux City officials have said the U.S. 20 improvements could facilitate the completion of Glen Ave Ellen Road east of Sioux City and open up areas on both sides of the U.S. 20 to development. We'll now move to quotes from the news. The first one is said by Skylar Limkeman, an attorney for the Iowa Fraternal Order of Police, on a bill that would dismantle citizen review boards that probe alleged police misconduct. And he says, what this bill does is it says we already have a civil service commission process here in the state of Iowa. We do not need a civilian review process. The next quote is from Carol Larvick, a University of Nebraska Extension educator and a master gardener, on the warm weather that has encouraged early budding in plants this year, but which could mean trouble if a cold snap hits. The trees and bushes and perennials, all of them have gotten too early of a head start. Next, we hear from John Remus, chief of the Army Corps of Engineers Missouri River Basin Water Management Division, on the expected low runoff into the Missouri River. Despite the increased runoff in the month of February and the improved soil moisture conditions, we expect the 2024 runoff to remain below average. Then, Representative Skylar Wheeler, Republican from Hull, on a legislative proposal to stiffen penalties for the non-consensual termination of a pregnancy. This bill is very simple. It increases penalties for crimes that are ridiculous, killing a mother or her unborn baby. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott, who last week cast a lone no vote on the city allocating $50,000 to benefit the warming shelter, which has struggled with budgetary shortfalls, and he said, "You've got $50,000 on a budget of $840,000. All you've done is put a Band-Aid that's not going to solve this problem." And then from South Sioux City Community Development Agency Chair Bruce Davis on the development that would add 104 acres of workforce housing. "If all that was developed in the next couple of years, then I'll be dancing because that means we were successful." And then we have a quote from Sioux City Recreation Superintendent John Burns on a new piece, interactive piece of playground equipment, sort of a giant video game that will be installed at Chris Larson Park. "It's cool that we've got one here. The riverfront is the absolute perfect home for it." And then we have a quote from Iowa House Minority Leader Jennifer Confrist on the opposition of Iowa House Democrats to the proposed "Don't Tread on Me" Gadsden flag license plate, revenues from which would fund training and education by National Rifle Association affiliated groups. And she said, "There are problems in this state that there are issues we are facing, and we are spending our time on a license plate to fund the NRA. And then our last quote is from Iowa Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison, on a proposal to create a $3 million grant program that would allow schools to pay for guns and training for staff. And he said, it is not about the gun. It is about the character of the person holding the gun. And now we'll move to Dear Abby in our first letter. "While I was visiting my father-in-law, a heated conversation turned violent. My husband, Rob, was helping his dad and a neighbor with a house project. When Rob's dad became upset at him, he lifted the power saw he was holding, turned it on, and motioned toward Rob, saying, 'You're lucky I don't slit your throat.' He said some other unkind things and we left. He has not reached out to my husband since, and Rob has deleted his phone number. His dad sent me a text taking no responsibility for his actions and blaming Rob, which is why we have now decided to cut ties. We have a teenage daughter, and my father-in-law has also texted her. We do not want her around him, and Rob wants to instruct her not to respond. The day his father acted like this was also the one-year anniversary of the passing of his long-term girlfriend, who was more like a wife. Should we tell our daughter not to respond to his messages? Signed, Threatened in Oregon." And the response: "Your daughter is old enough to know what is going on and to be able to respond to her grandfather's text. I'm not sure how you could stop her. However, she should also be made aware that, in a moment of anger, her grandfather threatened to kill her father, which is why you have decided it is safer to keep your distance. At the least, dear old dad owes his son an apology." Our next letter: "Is it acceptable to put someone on speakerphone without informing them? I recently had a conversation with my younger sister about our mother's health issues. In the background, I heard someone make a comment to her about something I had said about our parents. When I asked, 'Who is that?' she said it was her live-in boyfriend of 2 years, that I had been on speakerphone the entire time. I immediately ended the conversation. Please understand that no one in our family has met or spoken to this man other than my sister. To me, he is a stranger. I felt it was inappropriate for him to listen in on our conversation, whether it was a personal family issue or not. I'm not sure if violated is the right description for how I felt after hanging up, but did not sit well with me, even though nothing derogatory had been said. Am I behind the times, or did my sister make an error in judgment? I have not discussed my displeasure with her, but I plan to. My wife agrees with me, but says I should drop it and be mindful of my sister's actions going forward. Signed, Overheard in Florida." And on the reply: "The rule of etiquette is that the person you call should ask before putting someone on speaker if someone else is present. That said, Sissy and her boyfriend have been living together for 2 years. I doubt she keeps secrets from him. What she hears, she shares with him. The next time you want to discuss some family business with her, open the conversation by telling her you would like her to please not put you on speaker. Then cross your fingers and hope she complies." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, March 12th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.